This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Shouldn't you be at work?
Oh, here's Gascoigne. Gascoigne, he can finish it here! Paul Gascoigne! 2-0!
Lampard!
Brilliant!
It was in, no!
That surely crossed the line! Oh, it's in! It's so far in!
Thanks very much, Sepp Blatter.
Clean sheet, I call it. It's one of the most important things in football.
Nice to see home fans booing you.
Emil Heskey, could it be five? Yes, it is!
Paul Bowden to take it. Oh, and he's hit the crossbar!
Gerrard, it's Carroll! What a goal by the England striker! That's why he was brought in, and he's done the job.
Saved! John Pickford! England on the brink!
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Are you back in the score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, it
happened!
No!
Hello and welcome back to Quickly Kevin's World Cup Specials. I'm Chris Skull. Joining me as always, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And hello, fellas, Scotty Sellers. It's Michael Marden.
Hello.
Thank you to Paul Kark of Hereford for that one.
How are we? We're not talking about that. We're not talking about how we are we? We're talking about how were we in the past with old World Cups. As promised, no one cares about this World Cup anymore. No one gives a fuck.
I don't know. Some people do. Some people do care.
Well,
I mean, I'm struggling. It's so weird. I feel like this World Cup now is like an ex-girlfriend I don't want to know about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I hate the fact it's going on. I hate the fact the game's happening.
I just want it to be over. I'll be honest with you. In my head, it is over. I haven't watched the games. I barely know who scores, who scored. Apparently, Messi set up a really good goal. Haven't seen it.
Yeah, I did actually. Well, I didn't. Argentina-Croatia, I couldn't face watching. It was still too raw. And then I found myself France-Morocco game last night just constantly checking the score. So around 60 minutes, I was like, I'm just going to cave and watch it. And then through gritted teeth, saw the French go through. Oh, God.
Right, well, we've decided we're going to talk about three things to cheer us up today.
Yeah, how bad the French have been historically. That'll cheer us up.
Well, 2010, isn't it?
And then also we're talking about our dream World Cup.
And we're also discussing the worst teams England have ever put out in a major tournament to make ourselves feel better about the current one. But first, correspondence.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
It's in my hands today. I wanted to start with an email from Robert Allman, who we discussed last time, the fact that there's a new camera angle for penalty shootouts. He says, since Euro 2021, during penalty shootouts, the camera angle uses not the traditional camera in the gantry, but one directly behind the taker.
Yeah.
Peculiarly, penalties in normal time still seem to use the regular camera angle. They're right. But he's right, because the England-France game in this World Cup, was in the gantry, but in the penalty shootout...
That's not peculiar.
But he did say... So Robert Allman says, yes, I think the angle behind the goal gives a much better view of what the taker is facing, how the keepers look, and you can see how the penalty is dispatched. However, he says, this is in contrast with a dishonourable mention for Sky Sports Player Cam. Do you remember Player Cam?
Oh, yeah.
Where you could choose to spend 15 minutes at a time just watching one player and not the actual game, which I recall was in use for far too many seasons than it should have been. It was that, rubbish, player cam.
It was rubbish. It was so bad. And they'd have to, during the game, say who player cam had just switched to.
Yeah.
Do you ever do that, that at live football, if the game's boring? I find it quite interesting to just focus on one player. Do you know, like do my, like a bit like player cam. But then you can always go off it. Because, like, but it's quite interesting at live football to watch one player and see actually what they're just doing themselves, if you know what I mean,
yeah,
the whole time. But not enough. It's
not for
it's
15
weird,
minutes at a time.
Yeah. And now Stefan Iversen is on player cam. So if you want to go over to. And would it be a different chat? It'd be a red button, presumably, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it would. I'd love to see the stats of that because surely no one was doing it. It's so rubbish. I did it once. I just remember. Just because you're just like interested to see what on earth is this like, and then you realise it, you don't get any sense of the game. It's harder player cam than it is in a stadium watching a player because you at least get a sense of the context of everything else. With player cam, it would zoom right into him, so you couldn't even really have the context of where he was on the pitch. It was so tight on that individual.
I think there's also an interesting thing with like Sky is obviously about subscriptions. That is a Sky financial model. I wonder if it affected a if it sold any more subscriptions, the ability that you could do player cam.
Yeah.
It's interesting that actually, the subscriptions thing with Sky, because people consistently like complain about Michael Owen on BT Sport or complain about, I don't know, various commentators. Do you think the actual presentation of football affects the viewing figures or subscriptions at all? And I'm not talking about extra stuff like Premier League years or Soccer Box, but do you think anyone cares actually when it comes down to it who the host or the pundits are when they're buying their subscriptions?
That's a great question.
I suppose it engenders a loyalty to the brand. I like the Sky pundits, so I already have a... Were I someone who likes the Sky pundits, I actually do like the Sky pundits, it would engender that I... have good feelings towards Sky Sports. I suppose that's what it does. So it's not, it's a bit like in advertising, it's not
brand.
Like...
It's the brand.
Yeah, it's brand rather than specifically driving you towards it.
I always wonder, what percentage of people actually tune in and pay attention to the build-up and the post-match? Jimmy, I would reckon about 60-70%. It's just generally up there, but like a Premier League game, I reckon most people, 70%, are turning up 3 minutes before kickoff.
How much time have you got on your hands? You know, on Soccer Sunday, was it called Super Sunday? When they're in a fucking empty stadium, and you're like, that. So the game is that far away. The stadium isn't open yet. How much time have you got on your hands if you're watching it at that point?
But I think most people do what I do, which is that you just have it on in the background. If I know West Ham are playing at 4 and the coverage starts at 2 or something absurd, then I will just leave. I won't be watching, but it will be on.
Yeah.
Just hovering around. Do you want another one? This is a.
Yep.
I actually thought about this thought the other night, and Adam Kay has emailed it in.
What the?
We'll get to the maths of it.
Not the former doctor turned author.
Well, he's got a pretty good email address that suggests he is one of the first Adam Kays.
Oh,
but he says, well, he says, I was born in 1982. My middle name is Zico, after he was the player to score closest to me being born in the 1982 World Cup, which was a prearranged agreement with the family. Slightly dodged a bullet because the scorer before that was Juan Ufart.
Amazing.
Anyway, main point. This
Zico's
is
a good name.
It is, yeah, Zico. And a good story. That's kind of what you want out of a middle name. Main point. He says, England winning the World Cup in black and white and everything, very whole old hat, etc. But it was only 16 years before I was born, 1982. I ran this past mates who can't obviously do the maths, but Jesus, is there any, like, there's no way anyone born in 1982 would have thought that 1982 was just 16 years before that was 1966. And I thought that the other day. I was like, 1966 is so close to, like, 82 in those early 80s. It feels...
Yeah, well, I was 83, I was 1983.
I was 83, so there's only between 17 years before we were born.
17 years.
It feels like...
So it's the same distance to Euro Euro 2000 as 1966, my birth. But then I suppose you don't remember your birth. So really your memories start in about 1988, which is 22 years away. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it feels to me that the post-war period from 50s to 90s, or maybe even just 80s, there's so much social change between the 50s and the 80s. I'd say the 80s and 90s are pretty similar if we're I know this isn't the podcast to say that on, but I don't think it feels drastic change there. But there's so much change between the... And the decades are so different to each other. The 50s, you could picture that, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. That feels like a massive difference. Whereas how different does 2022 feel from 2002? Not drastically, I don't think.
No,
apart from the rise of the mobile phone. But I'd say social attitudes and stuff and kind of fashions and stuff haven't drastically changed. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Or am I just living in a bubble because it's happening now?
I think what's interesting as well about the 1966 World Cup is that it was only... I think there's only like 16 teams in it. And I wonder to what extent it's a big deal. Like football in the six... Like by 82, and I would say definitely by 1990, football is a huge deal. But in 66, is it, even though we won the World Cup? That's not many World Cups in either. How many World Cups have there been before 66?
Yeah, I think that's the other thing, is I don't think people were taking the World Cup as seriously.
No.
At that point.
So there's 16 teams. And I remember reading something Jeff Hurst said, which is that... What did you do the day after you won the World Cup?
Probably went on about it. That's what he's done every day since he won the World Cup.
But the day after the World Cup, he said that he just washed his car.
Yeah.
So I think that really gives a sense of what it really meant. Do you know what I mean? Although it's a big deal now that we won the Cup in 66, the day after, it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah. Michael, do you agree with those two theories? That A, it didn't matter, and B, time has slowed? Two quite different theories.
I 100% agree with the time has slowed thing. I think we've touched on it before, but sort of post, from the point of 2002 onwards, my sort of memory or the way my brain processes football gets increasingly kind of blurry. I have to really struggle to remember who won which World Cup and where it was set, and I often mistake moments and teams. Then prior to that, obviously it's your formative years. It's almost crystal clear because there are these kind of markers in my life and these moments. So I think it definitely does. In terms of it not mattering back then, yeah, that's fascinating. I never thought of that before. You know, was the World Cup in the UK something like the kind of the World's Fair, where it was a bit of a sort of an event, but actually outside of football fans, did it matter? You know, had England not won that World Cup, what would the relationship of this country be with football in the subsequent years, decades, and even now?
I think it's similar to more minor sports, that England have won the World Cup and we've made it matter. But for instance, the Cricket World Cup, which we won in 2019, I think if Pakistan had won that, no one would have mentioned it, because England won, it became quite a big thing. Or, well, it's a good example of that is... because women's football is growing rather than being where the men's game is, the women's Euros became a huge thing because England won it. But that's probably a similar situation in that it's a growing sport. So had England gone out in the group stage, it wouldn't have registered nearly as much with the public. I'd say it's one of those things.
I wonder if the England women winning the Euros was actually a bigger deal than England winning the World Cup in 66.
Well, if we've got any listeners that were... I mean, we don't have many old listeners, I doubt. If we've got any listeners that were alive in 1966, could you compare the experience of England winning the Euros this summer and England winning the World Cup in 1966? I'd love to know what the difference was experientially. Well, if you were alive for 66 and 2022, do get in touch, or if you have other reasons, this is how to get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. and sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Okay, so we're going to talk about three things today. We're going to start by talking about the worst times. And actually, it felt when we were that France have had at the World Cup, but it felt like this was something I needed to do 4 or 5 days ago. I've already completely got over the fact that France have knocked us out. So this now feels quite... I'm just quite interested in bad times the French national team have had. It's not soothing a wound anymore. I actually don't mind France. But there we go. Where do you want to start, Chris?
Well, should we start with an email from Richard McNaughton? This is a great thing. I didn't know this, what I'm about to tell you. Okay. Obviously, 2010, the France implosion is synonymous with Raymond Domenech. But actually, Richard's email taught me something I didn't know. Richard says, loves the podcast. He says his parents are English, but he's born and raised in France. And he says, I have no idea if what I am writing about is common knowledge in the UK, but Domenech, before the infamous bus incident, had already made the headlines following France's early elimination from Euro 2008 with one of the cringiest television moments ever. After a goalless draw with Romania and a thrashing by the Netherlands, France needed to beat Italy to make it to the knockouts. They ended up losing to Italy. Domenech had played no part in France's successful 2006 World Cup, having been sidelined by Zidane and co, and the team basically managed itself. This was the first time he actually was in charge of the team, as the old guard was out and the performance obviously was very poor from a France team. In the post-match interview, Domenech was asked what he would like to say to the people who were asking for his sacking. His reply was as follows: I only have one project now, to marry Estelle. So it is today that I am proposing. I know it is difficult, but it is in moments like this that we need everyone, and I need her. The interviewer amazingly glossed over that answer and moved on, but for viewers, that was not the end of it. The Estelle he asked to marry was a famous sports journalist called Estelle Denis, who was presenting the post-match analysis show for the Euros on French television. After the proposal, there was an ad break, and everyone was waiting for the next programme to come on to see if she was going to say yes. The show started, and she proceeded to ignore completely what had just occurred and decided to ignore the proposal. This is unbelievable. The whole thing was not mentioned once, and they never got married. In an interview years later, Domenech went on to admit it was a mistake because she gives great importance to separating her private and professional life. What a fucking idiot.
Oh my God.
Do you know what? Before this email, I was going to say that it felt like Domenech was harshly done by in 2010.
But I've been reading up on Raymond Domenech. The fact he was France, he kind of worked his way into being the French manager by surprise, a bit like Gareth Southgate, really. The kind of the under 21s route. I've read some incredible things about him. So obviously, one of the things I think maybe a lot of people know about him is he was incredibly into horoscopes. Are you aware of this?
No,
I have consciously not done any research on this topic because I thought all three of us are going to be doing the same research in the same place. So I'm coming in excitingly cold. I don't remember anything about this.
So he was a bit of a he was an eccentric, and one of the things, which was really the only thing I did remember about him, so it was the first thing I googled, was that he was heavily, and still is, into horoscopes and astrology. And there was a rumour that he denied that he dropped Robert Pires for being a Scorpio. But he's denied that. But so he'd get all the players' horoscopes done and stuff like that. He got promoted via the French FA thing. But then I think, I might be wrong, but I think like that doesn't discredit you. I think Amy Jacquet might have come through that route as well. Like, obviously, yeah, Gareth Southgate and all that route is fine.
Yeah, but he did it for a long. He did it for a long time. He was France under 21 manager for 11 years.
He got to the final in 2006, so that bought him, I suppose, some years, right?
Right.
Because you've got to quite a bad team to the final. Yeah, it's difficult to sack someone. I suppose they could have sacked him after 2008. 2010 is his classic period, which of course started with, and maybe, you know, they wish this hadn't happened now, but they qualified, obviously, via beating Ireland when Thierry Henry handled the ball.
Yes. Yeah. Cheeky.
Yeah. So that
was a sliding doors moment that is.
So that was a two-legged tie against Ireland at... France won 1-0 at Croke Park. And incredibly, Ireland won 1-0 in Paris, I suppose it must have been. And it went to extra time. And Henry handled the ball, setting up William Gallas to score the winner, which would obviously not have been given via VAR now. And Ireland wanted the game replayed. And I think I'm right in saying Ireland ended up just getting paid some money by FIFA as a kind of make-weight. They got given some money to kind of make up for it and to just kind of basically shut them up, I suppose. I don't know.
Wow.
Have you heard this before? That's
no,
true.
I didn't know that France... So FIFA gave them money?
Yeah, I think they did, yeah.
That's so weird, isn't it? It's like an admission of guilt.
Really? He hasn't broken a rule because the rule is the ref has blown... If the ref hasn't blown, then that was the rule. There's not a foul. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then they... go to 2010, and he sends home Anelka, or the French FA, the FFF, send home Anelka, and off the back of that, all the players
go. Do you know
on.
Why they sent home Anelka?
No.
So it was half-time. They lost their first game of their 2010 World Cup
with Dominic at half-time.
To Mexico, yeah. They're half-time, and Anelka says to Dominic, go fuck yourself, you son of a whore. That feels like a really French insult, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, they're always calling each other sons of whores.
But for the video we've seen, like, I thought that's like what happens in a dressing room.
Yeah, like that's all the time, isn't it? And also, I bet Anelka's saying that under his breath.
Yeah, but, I do.
But the reason why he got booted out was not necessarily because of that insult. It was the fact that Anelka refused to apologise.
Right. Okay.
That Dominic demanded an apology, yeah. And Anelka didn't give one. Which you can.
So you get
I can
sent
imagine
home.
Anelka.
And then at training the next day, they all... It's filmed, isn't it, training, which is incredible. It's an open training session and all the players refuse to train. They go and sit on the bus and they close the curtains on the bus. That's quite a nice detail of it.
Well, they actually, when they arrived at the training from where they got out and they signed loads of autographs... And then Patrice Evra had a row with the fitness coach because the fitness coach, he told the fitness coach, we're not training today. It's not happening. And then him and the fitness coach got in a big argument. And then they all get on the bus. So there's even more drama and nonsense before they get back on the bus and close the curtains. It's so embarrassing for a nation. It's a World
Cup.
Though?
I think it would be utterly thrilling if that happened with the England squad. Do you not think? Like, You know, like the popcorn gif. Like, it would be like so exciting. I wouldn't be humiliated to be English. I'd be like, I can't read enough about this.
But do you know what? Like, I think it's in a weird way, you would think that would be quite bonding, wouldn't you? Like, if the players are up in arms and they're all united around this, then surely that's going to lead to good performances because they're all going to be together. But that 2010 World Cup is an absolute disaster for France. I don't think they win a game, do they? I think they get one point. They lose to Mexico, lose to South Africa. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Like, in this situation, it flips on its head and you're like, I blame the players here.
Why do you miss that as an England fan? That we have... average. We had years of average to crap World Cups or not qualifying. We never really had a, what's the word you use that you like? A
implosion.
We never had an implosion, which I think's a shame. I'd prefer to have the highs and lows to the kind of constant okays.
Yeah. The closest implosion is probably Graham Taylor, isn't it? But the interesting thing that we've discussed before about the implosion of not qualifying for 94 is that even after a spate of bad results, it gets to the San Marino game and there's still a chance.
Yeah.
It's actually, even though it's an implosion, it's a very light one because even at the end there's still a chance we can qualify, having really cocked it all up.
I don't think there's an... And is this the case? The thing that is missing from the English mentality that means we never win tournaments is also the thing that leads to an implosion. It's the thing that gives you your edge. Because, you know, France would implode. Brazil, I'd say, imploded when they lost 7-1, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, Italy, they've got classic implosion written all over them, haven't they?
Is it like what Noel Gallagher says about Oasis, which is that they're like a Ferrari that looks amazing and goes really fast, but every now and again it'll spin out of control.
Exactly.
And that's actually, is that what you want from a football team?
Michael?
You want it to look amazing, but delicate, fragile emotionally.
What do you think of that theory?
I think that's really interesting. I've never thought of that before. Maybe there's something about the kind of English sensibility to do with, you know,
the stiff upper lip. Yeah.
You know, keeping it in-house, the pride, the dignity that means, that a variable? And when it goes wrong, it does go horribly wrong. But would you give, you know, would you sacrifice a couple of England tournament performances or a couple of implosions for a World Cup win?
Yeah, because the implosions are more exciting.
I'd rather we didn't implode in with such sort of lack of dignity. I don't think they should not play. They should not train, because I think they're professionals and you just get on with it. I think you can keep those politics, you know, as much as possible inside the dressing room. I don't think anything is kind of pronounced during a World Cup. You're just effectively saying we're going out of this World Cup.
Yeah.
And I think probably all of those players look back with a sense of regret.
Yeah.
But that kind of seasoning in the personalities of the players and the squads that makes them win, in the same way that, you know, any sense of injustice, the French riot, they pick it, they don't stand for it, whereas we sort of go, oh yeah, that's a shame, and then nothing really happens. So maybe you need that.
Oh god, well there we go. That's a great way.
But is it interesting, like, our greatest success, if you think about, did Gazza bring that quality in 1990? Was he the factor, the kind of the brilliant genius, overly emotional? That was what England needed. Did England always need a player like that to really reach their levels?
No, because I don't think that was our greatest achievement. I think we stumbled to the semi-finals with four quite bad performances, like, and two good ones, one of which was the defeat in the semi-final. Actually, the best we've done is under Gareth Southgate, which is solid and dependable and professional. So, and look at France now. They're not imploding anytime soon.
Do you know what I read that really annoyed me? That Mbappe could win two World Cups before he's 23. There's something about that that really annoys me.
Yeah, but think how much it annoys Neymar. Shall we talk about England? Shall we go through our worst ever England teams then, seeing as we kind of brought it back to England?
Can I just before we depart from France, there's one stat that someone said, Stuart Ellery sent this in, and it is astounding. France finished third in the 1986 World Cup, but then they didn't qualify for 1990 or 1994. They didn't need to qualify in 1998 because they were hosts, and then they won, which means they didn't need to qualify for 2002, which means between 1986 and 2006, France didn't qualify or have to qualify for a World Cup for 20 years.
That's amazing. That is a great bit
That's
of information.
That. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Stuart Ellery, thank you for that email. Amazing.
Brilliant. What's your worst ever England team that they've put out? Shall I start?
Yes.
Okay. I've gone back to Euro 92, England versus Sweden. I looked at all the games from Euro 92. He actually changed it up quite a lot. And I've got to say, like, Alan Shearer started the first game in Euro 92. But by the final game, absolutely, listen to this team. Okay, this is the England team that went out against Sweden. Compare this to our current team. Playing 4-5-1. Chris Woods in goal. Stuart Pearce at left back, fair enough. Des Walker at centre back, who's probably not in his prime, let's be honest. Martin Keown as your other centre back. David Batty at right back. Also on the right flank, Tony Daly, right midfield. Central midfield of Neil Webb, Carlton Palmer and David Platt. Andy Sinton on the left wing. And then Gary Lineker up front on his own, which I would say doesn't really suit his game. And your subs are Alan Smith and Paul Merson. That's only 2 years after Italia 90. And only 4 years between before Euro 96, which both are star-studded squads.
Yeah, the big red flag for me is always if a player at a major tournament is playing out of position,
yeah,
you're in trouble. Why is David Batty at right back? What has gone wrong there?
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it? David Batty, Neil Webb, Carlton Palmer, Andy Sinton and Tony Daly. And Martin Keown. I mean, Martin Keown's good, I suppose, but like Chris Woods in goal. I think I have to do well to find a team at a World Cup. If you name these, I'll name you these players who I'd say haven't had successful England careers. Chris Woods. I'll let you off with Des Walker and Stuart Pearce. Oh, well, obviously not Stuart Pearce. David Batty, Martin Keown, Tony Daly, Neil Webb, Carlton Palmer, Andy Sinton, Platt, Lineker and Pearce, and Des Walker are the only ones you could really say have had successful England careers there. Seven.
Yeah.
Batty, maybe you could say had a successful England career. I wouldn't say you remember his greatest moment as a success. How has that happened between two incredible teams and tournaments?
I was just going to say, the interesting thing with England is like sometimes you look at a classic lineup and you think like, what is that player doing there? But then you lose sight of the fact that that player at the time was seen as a really bright young thing. Like Andy Sinton at the time might have felt like a really exciting young player as opposed to the washed up bloke I remember at QPR.
Yes.
And historic England teams put a lens over that a little
bit. Yes, that's a good point. Like if Tony Daly had proved to be brilliant, you know.
Yeah, at that point, no one knew Tony Daly was going to turn out to be rubbish.
Yeah, exactly. It's an incredible team. Okay, what have you got, Skull?
So I've gone for recent memory, really.
Yeah.
One of the worst days of being an England fan in recent times, the 2014 World Cup, the final group game, Uruguay 2, England 1, Luis Suarez scored twice. Final group game.
No, middle group game.
Out. Was it middle group game?
Yeah, we lost our first two games. Yeah, we lost Italy and Uruguay, and then we played out a boring draw against...
Because this meant we were out, didn't it, basically, this game? So I just kind of gone for this team, really. So up front, Dean Sturridge.
Dean Sturridge, that would have been
fine. Some of his goals at Derby were incredible.
The thing with Daniel Sturridge at this stage is Liverpool. This was the season. I remember being quite excited about this England team purely off the back of this was the season when Liverpool almost won the league off Daniel Sturridge and Raheem Sterling and Steven Gerrard being really good. This was Daniel Sturridge's peak, but I will admit that's a small thing to say.
Wayne Rooney off on the left. As Wayne Rooney himself said, he was not up front.
Yeah.
But behind Sturridge, Danny Welbeck, which I've never understood. Never. Yeah. He's brilliant when he plays against West Ham, but the rest of the time, I think Brighton is his level.
Yeah.
Young Raheem Sterling, okay, fine.
How many strikers have they got on? Four?
So they've got like kind of one up front and then kind of an
three
attacking
around.
Midfielder. Yeah.
So Danny Welbeck's your number 10? Or is Danny Welbeck out wide and Raheem Sterling's your number 10, maybe?
No, Raheem Sterling's out wide, Wayne Rooney's out wide, and Danny Welbeck's behind Sturridge.
Oh, how bizarre.
The midfield, admittedly, I think is fine. Which Steven Gerrard, cracking on a bit age-wise, and Jordan Henderson, fine.
That's a good midfield.
The defence and the goalkeeper is where it falls apart in hindsight. So at left-back, Leighton Baines.
Wow!
And then the central defensive pairing, Phil Jagielka and Gary Cahill.
Wow!
How did I ever go into that World Cup thinking we would deserve something?
I think the front six is quite good, or the front seven, or whatever it is quite good. God, Henderson and Gerrard, Sterling, Rooney out of position, Sturridge, yeah. Well, yeah, okay, and who's
right back? Right back, Glenn Johnson.
Who by now, that back four is
by
something
now,
else, isn't it?
In 2014, has absolutely lost whatever he had.
Yeah.
And then has there been a fall from grace faster than Joe Hart in goal?
Wow, yeah.
At the time, Joe Hart felt like one of the leaders of this England team. And since, there was that one decision that Guardiola made, was like, actually, I don't think you're good enough. And next thing you know,
it's
Burnley.
Mad. It's mad.
So you look at that team, I just thought, in retrospect, the bench is just Jack Wilshere, Frank Lampard. Yeah. If there's a problem in defence, if Jagielka or Cahill gets injured, don't worry, we'll bring on Chris Smalling.
Wow.
Ben Foster, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Phil Jones, James Milner. Oh, this is a striker who came on late on in the game to change it when we were behind. Ricky Lambert.
Oh, wow. That is
Adam Lallana, Ross Barkley, Fraser Forster, Luke Shaw on the bench.
I don't think it's as bad, but is
it?
Don't
think.
I think, because I think it's a team of two. Oh, I don't know. What do you think, Michael? Which team would you field?
Well, this is quite telling, because the England team that I've picked is the same tournament but the Costa Rica game, the game after.
Oh.
So all the same players in a different sort of variation, because I think obviously we were out. Yeah, we were gone by that point, so he's probably given some players some minutes.
Oh,
but I think that first 11 for the Costa Rica game is... I think it's worse than the team that Scholl has just picked.
Okay.
And I know they are getting played, some of them, just to give them a World Cup cap. But you look at the bench for this Costa Rica game, it's Sterling, it's Gerrard, it's Rooney. You think, oh, blimey, we must be really great as an 11 if those three players aren't playing. Up front, Sturridge, same. Behind Sturridge, Barkley. You've got Milner on one side, Lallana on the other, Lampard and Wiltshire in the middle of the park.
Oh.
The defence is a joke. Luke Shaw, okay, decent back then.
Yeah.
Young, up and coming.
Decent
centre
now.
Centre-backs, decent now, yeah. Cahill and Smalling. In goal, Foster, right back, Phil Jones.
Fuck.
That is, I think Lampard aside, there isn't a single player in this 11 that, like you said, Josh, has had a good England career. Like, it's madness, that squad, that we went into that World Cup with any sense of optimism.
Yeah.
It's almost petulance, isn't it, from Hodgson there? It's almost like, well, I'm going to put any old team. Like, I'll drop you all because you all let me down. I'll put these people.
I think he's not done that. No, I think he's done we're out, let's give the people a runner. I don't think he's done a, I'll show you. I think he's done a...
Think?
No, this is a third place playoff situation, isn't it? The Roy Hodgson era is fucking atrocious.
What's mad about this Costa Rica game?
We
nil nil with Costa Rica at the end here. We crash out. This is pretty close to an implosion, actually. How is he given another roll of the dice 2 years later?
Yeah,
and we go out to Iceland.
That, isn't it?
How did no one know at this point he had to go? Why on earth did we keep him on?
Well, I think it's because we were in such a bad group, such a tough group. Do you remember this was the group that when it was drawn, Greg Dyke, who was head of the FA, kind of got caught on camera putting the knife slit across his throat, kind of mime to his mate. Like, this is Italy and Uruguay. That was the problem, because Uruguay were great. And I think us and Italy both went out of this group incredibly. I think you're throwing around the word implosion too much, Scholl. Just losing a load of games,
think?
Isn't it? Yeah. You're just doing badly. It needs to have
sticking
a
up
human
for your boy
factor.
Hodgson again.
It needs to have a human factor to it. And I think this was just we were outclassed. Well, there we go. I think there's an argument that 2012 would have been another real... 2012's got to be the forgotten tournament, hasn't it? I could tell you so little about us in Euro 2012, apart from Andy Carroll scored, which says it all.
Oh, my God, yeah.
The Hodgson era. Thank God we lost to Iceland, because in a way, it was the least dramatic era as well. At least Steve McLaren went out in qualifying. And at least Fabio Capello, we lost 4-1 to Germany. If the Hodgson era is six of the most forgettable years of English football you could ever imagine.
The mad thing about the Hodgson era is it starts bad and gets worse.
Well, he's given a pass, isn't he, on that first one, because he gets the job just before the World Cup or the Euros.
It is such a forgettable, awful era.
Well, let's cheer ourselves up with the greatest... We chose our dream World Cups. These are the things we're each been asked to provide. Location, number of teams of format, era of kits, host and pundits, mascot. You've got to come up with a mascot. Who sings the official song, and a rule change, and old and past players, maybe. I don't know. So, Skull, you go first.
Okay. So, location-wise, it has to be Germany or England. Am I allowed to have it in England?
You can have it in England.
I'll have it in England, thank you very much. And if I wasn't allowed to have it in England, it really bugged me doing this because you realise, like, how many people have had the World Cup twice since we've had it?
Yeah.
Like, USA are about to have it twice. Anyway, that's a different point. So it's hosted in England. Number of teams and format, I want it exactly as it is now, I think. Yeah. 32 teams, the exact same format. However, that said, as we established in the previous episode, I don't mind us playing around with the format next World Cup, but I'm quite happy with how it is at the minute. Era of kits, I reckon we're all going to say the same thing on this. I've gone for 1990. I think it's the best era for kits. How many of those designs are classic kits that you see the time?
Kits.
I think it's the best. When it comes to the coverage, here's my team. Anchor, Des Lynam.
Correct.
Pundits, Jimmy Hill.
Yes!
Even though I didn't like Jimmy Hill at the time, I look back and think he was great. So I want Jimmy Hill back. Alongside him, camera pans, it's Bobby Robson.
Bobby Robson?
Bobby Robson. ITV's coverage around 98, I thought, was really good. Bobby Robson was on it.
Was he?
I've gone for... the next three, I think, are interchangeable.
How many pundits are you going for?
Well, so Jimmy Hill was always there. Bobby Robson's every other day. And they've got another three. These are on rotation. Marcel Desailly, Martin O'Neill and Patrick Vieira. I think you do need people who have won a World Cup.
I've gone Martin O'Neill. I love Martin O'Neill.
And then
Martin
O'Neill's good value.
Yeah,
really
I thought
good value.
He was great. Okay.
And then mascot, I think if it's in England, it has to be Lion-O, you know, a lion. It has to be a lion.
Yeah.
And then if I'm allowed one player from previous World Cups to turn up and amaze us all, I'm going with Diego Maradona.
Michael?
I've gone in a very different direction.
Oh.
I'm really going to shake things up with the next World Cup or this Dream World Cup in that my location is the world. It's the whole world.
Oh.
It's called the World Cup. Now, I'm going to make it exactly that. It's the FA Cup, but the World Cup. It's a head-to-head knockout cup tournament. I haven't quite worked out precisely how many teams
64?
Are going to be in it. Maybe even more, because the volume of games. Yeah, because you need the volume of games, because a lot of teams, that for that first round, they're only going to play once.
Yeah.
They're going to go, so it's going to be split. So let's arbitrarily say it's 128.
Can I ask, are you going to seed it, or is it going to be...
No, it is completely random. And my logic is, you know, the European Cup, it had the decency to rebrand as a Champions League, because there was a league structure. So I'm going to go the other way, rather than call it the World League... because it sounds shit, I'm going to make it a cup. So it's going to be an unseeded, every single round unseeded, totally drawn out of, you know, a bowl. Two teams, winner goes through, second one's eliminated. Now, if you're drawn first as the home team, your opposing nation has to come to you. They have to fly to you, to your country, play in your home stadium. So everyone's got this kind of like mad little mini World Cup going on that builds momentum as your team goes on. But just imagine that TV broadcast of the draw, like every however many days.
And how often and is this happening over a month?
I mean, I haven't worked out the mechanics, but yes, probably. I think it would be an absolute nightmare and would never be played out that way again. But I think for just one World Cup, World Cup, one sort of mad cheese dream of a World Cup, that would be fun. Era of kits, same. I think 88 to 92 I went for. I'd like to see a lot of those classic Adidas and a return of properly Hummel on the world stage.
I
don't know if you saw the Denmark kits this year. They were a sort of a throwback to that. Lovely design classics. Hosts and pundits, Des Lynam, obviously. No second choice there. I'd also put Martin O'Neill because I thought he was brilliant, but I crossed him out.
He's popular, isn't he?
Yeah, he was great. He was always great. But I crossed him out at the last minute and I went in a different direction. And what I thought would be fun is to have Saint and Greavesy, but they're your only two pundits and they have to watch every minute of every game in a sort of almost like a kind of charity, like pundit-a-thon. and they're in some kind of Dallas bunker. And as the tournament goes on, they just sort of increasingly unravel mentally, psychologically, physically. So it's a sort of almost like a Big Brother type experiment with the pundits. Mascot, I've gone for, I'm calling this FIFA Stein's Monster. And you know that game was sort of like a parlor game where someone draws a part of a human and then you fold it down and then the person draws the next bit and you fold it and then at the end you reveal it. I'm going to do that with a mascot, but a set number of countries are kind of allocated a piece of the mascot. But the thing that you draw, the thing you connect to it, it has to have some kind of cultural relevance to your country. So, you know, you might have a burrito for a head, you know, a bulldog for a right arm.
Yeah.
And whoever is the guy that built and designed Chow is responsible for the actual physics and mechanics.
Nice. Really good. Really good.
Song, I think I just went for Bruce Springsteen because I wanted to see him play out.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
I toyed with the idea of running parallel to it, sort of at halftime, each nation would have their person they bring out, almost like Eurovision. So if, let's just say it's kind of England-Iceland, they have a sing-off at halftime, and then whoever wins that sing-off by public vote goes through. And I thought, oh, that would be great. And then I quickly realised England could win the game and Bjork could win the contest. And then what happens? Does Bjork represent England?
Yeah, or all the singers go in? That's like, a problem.
That just doesn't work. That's a massive format issue.
Do you want mine quickly? So, country. Do you know what I'm going to go for? Because I wanted a country where I thought, I don't want all the stadiums to look the same. Do you know what I mean? And I want a passion for football, and I want a country that hasn't hosted it much. I've gone Argentina.
Oh.
Because I think that would be... I think... That 78 World Cup, for all its issues, it looks great. All the ticker tape and the stadiums in Argentina. Whenever you see, like, River Plate versus Boca, it looks... Those stadiums look really, like, different to other stadiums. And also, they love football. Number of teams, 32. Format, classic. Era of kits, I've gone slightly earlier. So I've gone, like, 84 to 86, because I love that Denmark kit. But also in that period, you have teams that... They almost barely bothered with kits. Like, Argentina's kit is just their colours with the logo of the sportswear company and their badge on it. It's almost like a PE kit. So I think it's just a bit more rough and ready, but mainly for the Hummel. Hosts and pundits, Lynam, Full House, Martin O'Neill, obviously. Ian Wright.
Yeah.
I love Ian Wright for an England game. He's incredible. He's so enthusiastic. And then I think you've got to have the good foreign pundit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which was begun by Hullett. But I'm going to go with, who was really good for a World Cup, they had Leonardo on the BBC. And he was great.
Oh, wow,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, he was great, wasn't he? I remember. Yeah.
He was really good. I think he became awful as a human being because, like, he's all part of the PSG project and he... seemed to not be a good guy, but who cares?
And do you know what about Leonardo? It's so exotic, isn't it? Like, when they got him, it's so... I love... It's like, how have they got Leonardo?
Yeah.
It was real shocking.
And then mascot. I suppose a steak would be quite good for Argentina. Like a talking steak. Because that's... If you think about Argentina, that's what you'd go with, isn't it? A steak. Or a cow. What would you go?
A cow, yeah.
I think a talking steak with legs and, like, a knife and fork in his arms and a football, maybe. I think that'd be nice. Official song. I think Diana Ross has got unfinished business with the World Cup.
They've got to bring her back at the opening ceremony of the next World Cup, haven't they?
Yeah.
Although she'll probably be 90. She's going to be even worse shape than she was in 94.
She just did Glastonbury.
That's true. She can take a penalty. She just did
Exactly.
Glastonbury.
Exactly. So there we go. I'd enjoy all of those tournaments a lot.
Yeah.
It's been a joy to research France, England, and dream tournaments. We'll be back with another episode in a couple of days where we'll cover a few more topics that will make you feel good about the World Cup again.
Yeah. That's it for this week. Samuel Eto'o, time to go. Thank you for Jim in Hull. Send in your terrible outros to hello@quicklykevin.com.
Hit legs over the top!